This is Solve It for Kids.
Good to see you. Welcome to Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. Please welcome to the show my partner in exploration, the dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson.
Hello, Jed. How are you?
I am wonderful. What is going on in your world?
Oh, not much. I am so thrilled that we have an amazing expert on our show today because we are talking about engineering.
Hey, engineering. That is so much fun. You know, I love trains and I love to those guys up in front driving the train.
No. Not that kind of engineering.
Really? What kind of engineer are we talking about?
Well, we're going to talk about robotics.
Ooh.
Engineers who design different types of things. I mean, we have robotics. You could design a train. That would be okay.
That would be cool.
A train engineer.
Yeah.
Engineers are people who actually use their skills of critical thinking to solve problems and figure out how to build things. Like, I don't know, have you ever built something with building blocks like Legos?
Yeah.
Then you probably are an engineer.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I can't wait to meet our guests, but before we do that, we gotta take care of a couple of things first, right?
Yes, we have to say hi to our new Solve for Kids team members. First, we have Camila from Verona, Italy. And then we have Jovi in Kerala, India.
Oh, yeah.
So we are getting all over the place. People are listening to our Solve for Kids podcast.
This is amazing. So kids listening in Boston and Jacksonville and Los Angeles, they're listening to the show along with kids in Italy and India and China and all over the world. This is like amazing.
It is. It's so cool. I mean, science is everywhere, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, before we invite our guest, we have to figure out what problem he's supposed to solve, and then I'm supposed to spin this wheely thing that you created with all these different problems on it?
Yes!
All right. You're
time to spin the wheel.
How can we use technology to help us conserve the planet?
Ooh, this is a good one! How can we use technology to help conserve our planet? I can't wait for that. You must have someone really special lined up.
We do. So the person that is going to be the expert on our show today is Shaw Selby. And he is a conservation technologist and also a National Geographic explorer. And the cool part is I met him because he was the expert that I did my Everything Robotics book with.
Awesome, awesome. I guess it's time to welcome Shaw to the show. Hey, Shaw, how are you?
Hey, welcome.
Thanks, Phil. I'm happy to be here.
So how about you just start out by telling us what is an engineer and a conservation technologist? Because I have to say that sounds really cool.
Yeah, well, so conservation technologist is actually something that, you know, when I started calling myself that, it didn't actually exist yet. So it's a job that I sort of made up. But in essence, you know, I'm an engineer. So I went to school for engineering. I worked for 10 years on rockets and satellites and the rocket engines on satellites. And then wanted to kind of use the things that I had learned in engineering to do better in the world and try and help the planet somehow. And that's when I started to find out about the problems that we're facing around wildlife conservation and environmental protection. And I decided, hey, you know what? I'm going to try and use my engineering expertise to try and solve that problem.
Oh, that's so cool. So what kind of engineer were you, mechanical or?
No, my background is in chemical engineering. When I was working on the satellites, I was doing a lot of systems engineering and some electronics work. And, you know, now it's all across the board. I do a little bit of mechanical, a little bit of electrical, kind of whatever's needed really is what I do.
Well, Isn't that almost the definition of an engineer? Do whatever's needed, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Little pieces put together. So Shaw is here to help us solve the problem. How can you use technology to help with conservationism?
Yeah, so that's kind of what my whole focus is, and I'm trying to figure it out. It's, you know, we live in this time where technology is just everywhere, right? We have these smartphones that we use on a daily basis, like access to things like drones and all sorts of other technology is easier than it's ever been in history. I mean, we, you know, back in the day, I would say decades ago, or not even that long ago, if you wanted to kind of invent a new piece of technology, what you had to do was, you know, you had to design it, and then you had to get a patent, and then you had to try and find someone to give you enough money to build it and set up a factory to build it. It was very expensive, you know? And now we live in a time that if you have an invention or an idea, you can basically design it from your computer and you can send that file off to somewhere else in the world to get made. And, you know, 2 weeks later, your invention shows up at your doorstep. It's this amazing time that we live in now. And so I just try and use all of those things to try and answer some of the problems and the questions that we have around the environment and wildlife and where wildlife's going and climate change and all these sorts of things that we've been thinking a lot lately when it comes to our planet.
So give us some specifics. So what kind of technology have you developed and how does it help you learn about the planet and conservation?
So the first example I'll give is this project that we call FieldKit. And so the whole idea about FieldKit is, if you wanted to actually go out and measure the way the world is changing over time, if you're curious about things like weather patterns or air quality or water quality, things like that, the technology to do so, the sensors that you would have to buy to do that are very expensive.
Right.
And really hard for a lot of people to use. And so with FieldKit, we're trying to create a version that is low cost. It's easy for anybody to use. You don't have to be a scientist at a university. You could be a student, you know, a fifth grader. You could be an environmental activist or anything, you know, anything. You could use these tools and measure how things are changing in real time and then share that data with anybody in the world. So this is our big project that we're kind of focused on right now.
So is the FieldKit something they literally take out into the field, and how does it work?
Yeah, it's like it's a box that has some electronics on it and some sensors attached to it. And you kind of go out and you put it somewhere that you're curious about how things are changing. You turn it on, and we built an app so you can connect to it from the app and change settings and do all sorts of things. And then it collects data. You can walk away and come back later, and you have this really rich and interesting set of data that you can then upload to the website and explore and share with your friends, or, you know, do more science on and figure out whatever you need to do with it. So we try and make that whole thing a lot easier.
Wow, that's incredible. Have we learned anything specific from the data that FieldKit has gathered?
Yeah, so right now FieldKit is not yet available to anybody, for anyone to buy. We've just been using it with some of our partners on some projects. So over the last couple of years, we've been deploying FieldKit in the Amazon rainforest. So measuring things like water quality, how the floods are changing, and weather in the Amazon. We've deployed some of them in places like the American Prairie Reserve up in Montana, or the Jaw Reserve, which is a rainforest in Cameroon in Central Africa. So right now we're just deploying a bunch of these, and the scientists that we're working with are taking that data and they're using it to either gain some insights about, like, you know, the way that the area is warming, or the way that temperatures are changing, or the way that water quality has changed over time. And then a lot of times what they use it for, and this is kind of an interesting use, is, you know, they're already out there doing a bunch of science. They're, you know, monitoring animals or trying to find new species. And, and in the past, when you did that sort of science, you just only had kind of the observational part. So you only had the part that the scientists are like writing down in notebooks and things like that. And all this background data. So like data about, you know, what temperature it was, what the humidity was, how much light was in this area, what the water quality is, all this stuff usually just was not part of it. But now you can combine that very easily with this observational side of things. And this allows scientists to learn new things. So like maybe they find that an animal only comes out when the temperature is at a certain level, or different sort of stuff. And the more we learn about these little nuances about nature, the better we can protect it. So that's kind of the plan, is to better protect
it. That is so cool. So, I mean, you don't even think about technology giving you all this data, but here you are finding out all of these amazing things, as you said. So the question is, where do you put this? Do you, like, put it on the ground? Does it sit on a tree? Do animals bother it, you know, kind of pick it up?
Yeah, I mean, you can, it's got little, we make a little box for it, and the box has these little flans that you can put on things. So we've put them on poles before, we've wrapped them around a tree just so it kind of stays there. You mostly don't want it to get lost, right? You want to be able to come back to it and find it later on. So you can bounce it on anything. This version that we have right now, animals haven't really messed with it before, but previous ones that we've done in the past have had those sorts of problems. I remember I was on an expedition in Botswana back in 2015, and I deployed one of these field kit sensors by a bridge and left it there overnight, went to sleep in the tent, and came back. When I came back in the morning, we found that a big chunk was broken out of it. And we didn't know what that chunk was from until we looked at this camera trap that we also had there that was monitoring that area. And we found that a hyena had actually came up and chewed, took it a big bite out of the side of one of my sensors. So, you know, that's the whole thing about being a conservation technologist, is we're building these things, this electronics that's supposed to go in places where electronics doesn't usually go. And so then you have all sorts of problems that come as a result of it.
I think this is really neat, because this is going to give kids a real chance to be part of making changes in the world. Right now, when they're kids, they can be a part of this amazing scientific team that's gathering all this information and figuring out problems.
Yeah, and the great thing, too, is, you know, kids are brilliant at technology nowadays. I mean, we had to kind of learn it along the way. I remember a time when cell phones didn't really exist, and now they're everywhere. And so, but like with kids, you give them these tools and they get it immediately. They understand how to go through these apps. So we actually, when we're working with FieldKit and other projects, like, we have a harder problem in dealing with kind of the older generation of scientists and teaching them on how to use these tools, as opposed to the young generations or the students that just pick it up and they know how to use it immediately.
Oh yeah, they're so smart. When I wanted to get on Instagram about a year ago, and I had to get my 20-year-old to show me how to do it. I was just like, and she just kept saying, you have to do it all with your phone. And I was like, can't I just take a picture with the camera? She's like, no. Just no, Mom. But you did say something I want to talk about, because I know what they are, but explain to kids what camera traps are, because I think those are really cool out in the woods or wherever you set them up.
Yeah, camera traps are great. So they're actually a really big part of how scientists study ecology, or they really, when they want to measure what kind of animals are in an area, they'll use a camera trap, which is basically like this little box that they can attach to the side of a tree or on a pole, and the box has a motion sensor on it. And when it sees motion pass, it takes a picture. And so there are also things that are used in other areas. So conservationists aren't the only users of camera traps, but they've taken them and they've done a lot of really great research as a result of it. And one of the projects we've been working on is, you know, once you use these camera traps and it takes all these pictures, a lot of times the problem is you get that camera trap back and there's, you know, 15,000 pictures on that camera. And then you basically, right now, the way it works is you have one person who sits down and they click through all 15,000 and they try and say, oh, does that look like it's a deer, or is that a tiger? Or, you know, they're trying to figure out what's in these pictures. But one of the exciting things in conservation technology nowadays is how you could use artificial intelligence and some of these kind of new systems to automatically know what's in the picture. So it's a lot like the same thing that when you take a picture on Facebook or on, you know, a smartphone, it knows what your face is. Like, it can say, oh, this is a selfie and this is not a selfie. So that same sort of technology is the basis of, like, this is like how you can understand what sort of animals are in these pictures.
Isn't that amazing, Jed? I find that amazing.
It is. It really is amazing. And, you know, one of the other things I think was amazing is that you came up with your own job. You created your own job and your own title. How does that happen? Do you have to ask someone permission to do that?
Actually, no, I don't think you do have to ask. I think, so, you know, when I first started working on this, both engineering and conservation were very, very disjointed, you know, and,
yes.
and there were a lot of early meetings I was in where I was the only technology person and everybody else in the room was a scientist or an environmental lawyer or, and, you know, and when I would start talking about technologies, it felt like that was something that didn't find a place, have a place there. And, but I really believed that the intersection between, you know, wildlife conservation and technology, that there was some opportunity there. So I kind of kept on pushing it. And, there were people who believed that that was also an area that there was a lot of opportunity. And that one of those organizations is the National Geographic Society. So right. they made me an explorer. They gave me this platform to kind of talk about this a lot. And this job kind of just arose, and it's my dream job. It's super excited to have it now. But I think that there's a lot of these opportunities. So, you know, when the people listening to this podcast are thinking about what they want to be when they're older and what kind of jobs they want to have, don't only think about jobs that actually exist, because there's a lot of jobs that will exist in the future that don't exist today.
Right. Maybe something somebody has never thought of, but like you said, taking two pieces. I mean, now it's kind of funny when you think about it, you're describing the technology you're using to help scientists. And so we're all just like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
But you were the one that kind of had to put those two together, which is awesome.
Yeah, and we think a lot about too, like how we can go about that differently. So, you know, in the past, scientists have used technology, but it was developed in a way that made it very expensive or hard to use.
Yeah.
And so what we do as conservation technologists is like we think, okay, let's design a new technology, but let's pretend that the number one user, that the core user is somebody who's doing this conservation work. And that makes us make all these different decisions about what we want to do and how it's going to look and how much it costs and all this sort of stuff. And it makes it so that this solution is actually useful to the people who are out there using it.
I love that you've been able to go to the Amazon and Botswana and the Prairie Reserve. What's the most interesting environment you've been working in?
That's a really, really hard question. We go on expeditions a lot. So, you know, we have technology on glaciers. We have technology in rainforests and, you know, savannas, like in wetlands, all these different places. And so, you know, I would say some of the places that I think about the most that I really enjoyed working in, one is, we built these sensors that monitored how a glacier is melting in three-dimensional space. And that was the Bow Glacier in Banff National Park up in Canada, which is an absolutely beautiful place.
I've heard it's gorgeous up there.
It's incredible. Yeah. And, you know, I did a lot of work in the Okavango Delta in Botswana. And that is just an absolute like wonderland of animals. I mean, there are some places where we would be on a floodplain and I would look out, and there would be so many animals in front of you, like zebras and elephants and giraffes and everything just hanging out with each other, that it felt like you were in the middle of a Disney movie, like Lion King or something. It was just completely absurd how much there was. And the rainforests are amazing places to work. They're, it's very difficult. So our project in Cameroon is like a 30-mile hike into the middle of a rainforest. You're so remote and away from everything. That it makes like putting technology into these places really difficult. You have to think a lot about what you need and what you won't need and how things break and how things fail, so that you're packing everything with you, putting it on your back and taking it into these places.
Are you using satellites there? I mean, how do you get your information? Is it a satellite uplink?
Yeah, I mean,
it's not like they have cell phone towers, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, sometimes it's satellites, but satellite uplinks right now, are pretty expensive, and it's not going to be expensive, I think, in the future, because there's lots of people working on stuff about that. But right now it's very expensive. So sometimes the things that we put out there are just recording data. They're saving it on like SD cards and things like that.
Right.
And then people have to go and get it later on.
But
the one thing is, when you are working in these sorts of places and you have a problem, you can't just turn to the internet and Google a solution, you know? So you have to
up Google Maps and go, where do I go? Which way
exactly.
am I going?
Yeah, no, you're far out from there. So it's a lot of planning and making sure that you, whatever failures you encounter, you can kind of move past them.
So So who's on your team when you go out there? Is it just you? Do you take a team of scientists with you, or?
Yeah. So everything we do out in the field is like a partnership with some scientists or a nonprofit or, you know, whoever it is that's working in that area. So for example, our Amazon project is working with the Wildlife Conservation Society. Oh. You know, our project in Cameroon is working with UCLA, the university. So we go out with scientists who work for these organizations, and they help us to guide us to where we need to put these things, and we train them on how the technology works. And then on my side, there's, you know, we take engineers with us who understand the technologies and know the technologies. And sometimes the team is made up of a couple of different people. So this last expedition we did in December in Cameroon had one expert who's an expert in tree climbing, because we were putting the sensors really high up in the tree, you know, like 20 meters up in the tree. And then we had an expert in data and visualization, because they were taking the data and doing interesting things with it. There's a couple of us engineers, and then we have the scientists that work in that area. And they're all part of that expedition.
I love, and I'm amazed that there are tree climbing experts.
Yeah.
That's a job. That's
a job.
So cool.
See, there you go, kids. Yeah. That's a job. You can do that. I'm thinking two words, Jed. Field trip. We need to go with Josh.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That would be so fun. Although I don't know about the 30-mile hike, and I will not climb trees.
So. Yeah, I mean, we aren't going places that are easy to get to typically. So yeah, it's a bit of a trek to get out to these places.
Shaw, you mentioned failures a bunch of times. We love celebrating epic fails. Is there a story of a failure you can share with us that was amusing or especially epic?
Yeah, I mean, failure is such a part of every single thing we do that it's second nature. I mean, the engineering process really is about controlling the failure, understanding the failure, and improving on that failure, right? So as we build things, we start with prototypes in the lab, we build them, we find all the issues with them, we try and fix it, and we iterate on that until we get to a point where we're like, this is ready to go out into nature. So it happens constantly. It's part of every project. But we've had like a bunch of sensors that we put out in places that just, basically the batteries died immediately and they stopped working. And these are in super remote places. We've had, you know, I also do a lot of work with drones for conservation, and I've lost a lot of drones into the middle of the ocean, and they, you know, unfortunately we weren't able to get all of them back. So, you know, sometimes those things happen. It's all kind of part of us learning and understanding this better to get this really hard to get data. So to understand the way the planet's changing in ways that we can't do it without these tools.
Boy, I would be so bummed out if I trekked 30 miles into the rainforest to put up a sensor and then walk back and then found out the battery died.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's not fun. It's definitely not fun, but it teaches you a lot about batteries and also how to be prepared, what sort of things you need to do while you're there to make sure that doesn't happen, so that you could walk away with some sort of confidence that the thing is working. But I will say that moment that you close the door on these things and turn around and walk away is always a little bit stressful, because you never really know.
Please work. Please work. Please work. So what are some things that kids can do for conservation around where they live or maybe places that they visit? Do you have any tips for them?
Yeah, definitely. So there's a lot of like pretty cool tools that are coming out that allow people to help with this sort of thing. There's a lot of work in what's called citizen science. So citizen science is part of what we're doing with FieldKit, but it's also, it's like, how can you create these tools that just allow regular people, anybody, anywhere, to be able to kind of contribute to these bigger projects. And one really great one is this group that we work with out of the California Academy of the Sciences, working on this app that's called iNaturalist. So the app you can download on any phone that you have. And basically what it is it's a camera that allows you to take a picture of like a plant or an animal or an insect or whatever it is, and upload that to iNaturalist, and scientists will tell you exactly what species that is.
That is so cool.
Yeah. And the cool thing about it is, like the act of understanding what species are in a certain area is kind of this thing that they call like biodiversity monitoring. So how can we monitor the diversity of the plants and the animals in an area? And in the past, this was something that a bunch of scientists had to get together. They had to go on an expedition. They had, you know, a paper and pen, and they're writing down all the things that they were seeing. It was very expensive, took a long time. But now iNaturalist makes an app that anybody can help with this thing. So you can go and take pictures in your backyard, and we can see that these animals are in this area, and that helps us get a better understanding of the world, which is like really, really cool to be able to do.
Well, and you can also identify perhaps species that aren't supposed to be there, right?
Yeah, definitely. So those are usually called invasive species. So right. Species that have came into an area that they're not supposed to be. That's really important for scientists to know. And then the other thing is you can, there's been some times on iNaturalist where people have actually discovered new species. So that's kind of a thing you could possibly do. Maybe that picture of a butterfly you're taking is actually a new species, and you could help to discover a new one.
I could see it right now, the Swanson butterfly.
I don't know. As long as it's not the Swanson snake, right? Okay, like you get a picture of me running away from it.
Shaw, I'm wondering, where did your passion for nature come from, especially for someone who spent so much time learning about technology? You have this great passion for nature.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so nature is always something that I really cared about. I have always considered myself an environmentalist. I was a scuba diver and hiker and all these things when I was younger. But I just always saw that as a separate thing outside of what I did for a career, which was engineering, what I wanted to do. I always knew I wanted to be an engineer, but I also liked the environment. And those two things felt very separate. And I've just been very lucky to kind of bring them together in that made up career that I
Yeah, but it seems to be working for you though, right?
Oh, yeah. It's great. I mean, it's taken off. There's more projects that come to us than we can actually handle. And you know, I've got a big team of people working on this sort of stuff. So it's really exciting.
Does it take a certain amount of courage to wake up one morning and say, I want to create my own job?
Yeah, I mean, it does. You know, it's quite scary, especially since, you know, as an engineer, you typically make a pretty good salary, and for you to walk away. And what I did was I walked away. I started a nonprofit. And that nonprofit is something that you don't see a lot of nonprofits being, which we're like an engineering company. We're a technology development lab. That's a nonprofit. And so, you know, that was a leap to make, but fortunately a lot of people kind of understood the need, for that sort of thing. So we've had great partners.
And you're like some of the guests we've had so far where everybody seems to be like, everyone can't see you, but you have a big smile on your face and you can tell that you're very passionate about what you do. And that's something I think that everybody needs to understand, because sometimes when you think of engineers, because, you know, I went to an engineering college, I went to the Naval Academy, and they think of engineers as just, you know, very kind of staid people that just figure things out. But that's not true, right? You can be as excited as anybody else about what you're doing.
Totally. I hear that sort of stereotype about engineers all the time. And most of the engineers that I work with aren't like that, right? They're very excited. I know a lot of engineers, even at companies like Microsoft or, you know, a lot of these big organizations that are just as excited about this stuff as I am. So I think that's, we're in this position where we could take these sorts of engineering skills and really try and fundamentally make this planet better. And there's a lot of people who are thinking about that, not only in conservation, you know, in things around climate change or, you know, environmental
the ocean. Cleaning up the oceans. I think there are engineers that are also working on like getting plastics out of the ocean and stuff
Totally. Plastics, all this stuff, like all these major issues that we find, you know, our world facing, there's a lot of very excited engineers that are working on that sort of stuff. And I think that's an important thing to see, that like, you know, being an engineer doesn't mean that you have to be this like introverted person who just works on a very small little thing that nobody ever sees, right? It could be big ideas and it could be big projects that you do.
Exactly. Well, we like to challenge all of our listeners with something to do. So do you have a challenge for our listeners today about conservationism or something?
Yeah. I mean, I think my challenge would be to go and try and use iNaturalist in your own backyard and just understand what's in that area. I think one of the things that a lot of people don't really know is like what sort of animals live around them, what sort of plants are around them. And as people start to learn that, they start to get a little bit more kind of connection to those areas, right? And this isn't even something that's only an issue, you know, in the US, like anywhere, all over the place that we go, like you find people who are living just right next to amazing nature and they don't really even know what's even in there. And as you can kind of learn more what's in there, then you start to care about it more. So
what we would like you to do, listeners, is take a picture of something in your backyard, send it to iNaturalist, and then also if you ask your parents if you can send it to us on Twitter, tag us on Twitter and Instagram. We are at KidsSolve, and we would love to see these images. We'll tag Shaw so he can see some of these cool images that you guys have taken of conservation or just animals or anything in your own backyard or the park down the road or wherever you choose to go.
Yeah, I would love to see that. I think that'd be fantastic.
This has been such a fun interview. Shaw, thanks so much for sharing this and inspiring us and being with us today.
It was my pleasure. I'm very happy to be here.
Jennifer, Shaw was amazing.
I know. Doesn't it make you want to get your boots on, grab a backpack, and go out into the woods or the forest and just start helping these people right now? How cool would that be?
I know. To think that we have the power. It doesn't matter if you're 9 years old, 10 years old, or like almost 100 like me. We all have the power to help save the world. This is exciting.
This is really exciting. And don't forget, kids, to go and do Shaw's challenge, because this is really fun. And so if you forget what it is, go to the website, solveitforkids.com. Make sure you click on the challenge page. There you can learn more about Shaw. You can actually see some of the links that he gave us to show some of the conservation efforts he's involved in. There's also a chance to win a free book if you tag us on our Instagram or Twitter at KidsSolve, or just leave us a comment or send us an email, because we want to hear what you think about this awesome episode.
Yeah, and if kids want to be part of our Solve It for Kids team, what do they have to do?
They just go to our website, again, solveitforkids.com, click on Join the Team, and go to our Patreon page and sign up with your parents' permission.
This is awesome. Hey, Jennifer, I've had such a great time. I can't wait for next week.
I am so excited for our guest next week. But in the meantime, enjoy your week. Go out, have fun, look for science, and listen to us on
Solve It for Kids.